Hello and welcome again to Sport Unlocked, the podcast giving you the lowdown on the week's sports news.
As ever, you can message us at Sport Unlocked on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And we're always grateful if you can hit subscribe to listen to myself, Rob Harris, alongside Tarek Pandya from the New York Times and Martin Ziegler from the Times, joining us this week from Wimbledon on his tour of summer sporting events.
Yep, Headingley last week, Wimbledon this week. The sun is shining relentlessly. So hopefully it will be as good as the cricket was today.
Martin, you've been attending these various sporting events, and you're trying to get to a world class level in a particular sport. I understand you've been playing paddle twice a day, every day for the last 2 weeks as well. Is that right?
Not quite that often, but I did play yesterday and managed to whitewash my son. Me and my partner whitewashed my son, just to say it was. We won 3 games to love without losing a single point. So I think
And as many ranking points for you in your paddle as there is available for players at Wimbledon this
week.
Yeah,
big thing in a way that Wimbledon, is the ATP and the WTA have stripped the ranking points from Wimbledon, so the players playing here won't get any ranking points. But it hasn't stopped people turning up. All the players have come, apart from a couple of injury withdrawals. And actually, I think Wimbledon are saying it's the players who are suffering from this, not Wimbledon itself.
Yeah, I got the chance to go down to Wimbledon myself this week. Actually, it was a son of a former tennis executive who was playing, Jack Draper, son of the former Lawn Tennis Association chief executive Roger Draper, who was in action.
Roger Draper, who famously was the highest paid chief executive of a British sporting governing body at the time. I think we've got more than £600,000 a year, which is nice work if you can get it.
Well, of course, this is the first fully normal Wimbledon since 2019, cancelled in 2020 because of the pandemic, limited crowds in 2021 as things were opening up again. So no restrictions at all in place this year. Well, apart from several players having to drop out due to positive COVID tests during the week. But what are the crowds looking like? Are they actually back in big numbers? Are the queues pretty extensive from what you've seen down there?
I mean, the crowds are back in sort of usual numbers. But actually, what is different compared to previous years is that the queue is, the famous queue where people sort of camp to get ground passes, it's not been nearly as long this year. And I think there's probably a sort of variety of reasons for that. People getting out of the habit, some people not wanting to sort of spend hours standing next to other people, but if they're still feeling the sort of fears around the pandemic, is this just younger people who would stand in those queues have their sort of ways of wanting to consume sport change, and are they less willing to commit to all those hours just waiting?
Do you think the from the broadcast numbers, I suppose we'll find out whether the appetite for Wimbledon is as big as it was in the past anyway, whether the people coming or not. And also, Martin, the pandemic in the UK, certainly it feels like it's something that is in the past. People are going to work, transport's busy, etc. But Wimbledon still has these pandemic rules, 3 positive tests, meaning, did it mean these players are eliminated? What's the circumstances with those guys, Martin?
Yeah, no, the rules still stand that if you test positive, then you have to withdraw. I know that's, I think a lot of competitions are the same. In fact, I mean, a lot of workplaces are still the same. I mean, my own workplace is like that too. And yeah, that's definitely what happens at Wimbledon.
In terms of the actual experience going to Wimbledon, it is pretty reasonable, isn't it? Under £30 for the ground passes. If you do manage to get in, you are allowed to take some of your own alcohol in and food, unlike some other sporting events. So it can seem this maybe costly event, given all the sort of the traditions and heritage around Wimbledon and how it appears. But it is affordable if you can get in.
Yeah, I think it is good value. And then there is this system at Wimbledon where you can, if people are leaving the show courts, they hand their tickets in and you can get their tickets. So, it's still an experience for people who don't need to have, haven't got huge amounts of money to spend and can still get to a major sporting event.
Well, a lot of spending in European football this week, away from the actual transfer window, which is underway. On the TV rights front and UEFA starting to do those deals for post 2024, the new format for the Champions League, more games, the new format for the group stage, more teams in the competition as well. And they've clinched the deals in the UK and France so far, and they've produced an uplift.
25% uplift in France with the deal with Canal, and a 15% in the UK. The BT Sport have held onto the bulk, but we've got the first time that Amazon is going to show Champions League matches in Britain, and also a sort of fairly significant highlights deal with the BBC, which I think will become quite a sort of important one.
You say that there's been these uplifts. I guess in cash terms, there is, as you just mentioned. But this new format has scores of more games, doesn't it? So there is going to be a lot more football on the television that they're buying for. So I guess for me, on a per game basis, it largely feels probably flat. There's not some great new boon for European football. And I don't think it was ever likely to be. The French increase, I suppose, yes, 25%, but the number of games is significant across all three of the UEFA tournaments.
Yeah, in the current 32-team Champions League group stage, there are 96 games, and the new format expanding to 36 teams with 8 games per team rather than the current 6 will mean there'll be an additional 64 games all before the round of 16, because there's a knockout round as well for those who might just miss out on automatic qualification from the group stage as a sort of second chance safety net. But it's perhaps the highlights deal is an indication of the fact there'll be so much content out there in terms of live games. The fact maybe there'll be that increased interest just to sort of sit back and try and take stock and watch all the masses of action, the key parts of it by the end of the match days on the Wednesday.
I think that's exactly right, actually, Rob, because that's why I think it's going to be quite a coup for the BBC, because I do think, you know, with all these games in there, you can just, like, you know, when you watch it now, you can flick between, you know, up to 8 or whatever. Well, then actually, if you're prepared to stay up late, it might be just the easiest thing to watch everything.
Just to Rob's point about all those extra games, it feels like we're going to be drowned in football. And the UEFA president, Alexander Seferin, said as much recently, but didn't talk about all those extra games in his tournaments. Instead, his focus was on leagues, saying he wanted a maximum of 18 games in top 18 teams in top flight football, and one cup competition. And again, it felt a bit rich, you know, reduce games everywhere else, but let's increase the amount of football in our competitions. And again, for me, this is the tension that has continually been in football. The leagues are clearly going to fight back. Can you imagine the Premier League saying, "Yeah, sure, we'll reduce the number of our games so you can have more"? But this is the European football regulator, guys, and maybe UEFA's job is to regulate football and not run competitions. It's something that people have been talking about,
as highlighted by the fact that obviously they've got this necessity to bring in more revenue, as they would see it, to reinvest within the 55 domestic FAs across Europe. And that requires them to obviously look at means of increasing revenue, which puts the focus on their own competitions, which then can increase the load on players and create that resistance and pressure points with the domestic competitions as well, in terms of their ability to create the value as they want for their own markets.
Yeah, it's a good point. It also feels like a bit of a conflict of interest here, whereas you're able to protect your own and then have that outsized influence on other stakeholders in football. It's something that's going to be interesting with this court case with the Super League coming up on July the 11th. I wonder if it's one of the points that's going to be interrogated, whether UEFA is acting as a fair monopoly or as an abusive one. I think the outcome of that's going to be really interesting.
And this is the court case all stemming from the initial attempt at that breakaway by the Super League rebels in April 2021. And this will be a key moment, won't it, to determine actually did they have the the right to do so.
No, we're talking about, you know, UEFA having all this power. So basically, Sheffrin saying league should be reduced to 18 while adding 70 more games to his stuff.
We've also had some news from Barcelona, one of the Super League rebels, as they attempted to be, in terms of their ability to generate cash themselves so they can get new signings over the line so they can comply with the La Liga financial regulations.
Yeah, this is something that's been simmering all summer. Barcelona, of course, with Real Madrid and Athletic Club de Bilbao, shied away from this long-term 50-year CVC deal La Liga did to give the American Investment Fund about 10% of their TV rights for 50 years. An incredible deal for CVC. Barcelona have instead gone with Sixth Street, another American company that recently done a deal with Real Madrid, for 25 years for 10% of their TV rights. And Barcelona, in absolute desperate financial straits, need this cash injection in order at least to try and get back into the transfer market. Their fans are probably hoping they don't waste all that money like they did last time and get into a deeper hole.
You know, when there were similar sort of, not quite such big deals as this, but similarly in the past, Premier League clubs have sold effectively or borrowed against their TV rights from commercial financial institutions. So they're almost like payday loans, really. Some of them got into really sort of big trouble financially from doing this, because they, you know, they're paying huge amounts of interest basically to get this money in advance. Isn't this what Barcelona are doing, but on a much, much bigger scale?
Yeah, what you were talking about is these factoring agreements, which industry jargon, where you could, it's about your receivables. So like you said, it could be TV rights, it could be transfer income as well, and they've got to sort of give that away. But here it's not really an interest, it says 10%, and it means 10%. The money will go straight to the company. It's effectively having a minority partner in your TV rights for 25 years. So Barcelona is going to only get 90% of the TV revenue, come what may, whether it goes up, whether it goes down. Sixth Street, this financial institution, will get 10%. So strictly not really an interest payment or anything like that. It is just 90%.
Be interesting to see when it comes to the around the new financial fair play rules, whether this sort of big chunk of income can be taken as sort of income from one season, or if it has to be spread out over the length of the TV deal.
That's a really good question. I mean, there's so many question marks over what this new financial fair play thing actually is, what the wherewithal of the people who are tasked with looking at it. Rob, there was a new sponsorship announcement as well at Paris Saint-Germain, wasn't there, this week, speaking of financial fair play?
Yeah, they've managed to secure Qatar Airways as their new shirt sponsor.
What?
Really?
From the blue?
Incredible.
Tough negotiations there.
Yeah, amazing how they managed to get that one over the line.
And again, that's something that these regulators are going to have to look at, fair market value. You know, you've got to think how this team of people, not that many of them, how they get through all of this stuff. With each club is going to do whatever it can to get as much as it can. You know, mentioned PSG, been through various scrapes with them, Man City, Newcastle are now here with this. They announced something new as well, an away shirt that looks like Saudi Arabia's kit. Quite a lot going on, Rob, Martin.
Yeah, and Newcastle have also got a sort of related party deal announced. They got with the sleeve sponsor Noon, which is a marketplace based in Saudi Arabia, and surprise, surprise, half owned by the Saudi PIF, which owns Newcastle United.
I suppose on the Qatar Airways sponsorship of Paris Saint-Germain, Qatar Airways are a big airline. People use them to fly all over the world. Now Doha is a big hub airport, so you can see why actually they have that appeal to sponsor, more so than Qatar Tourism being a sponsor of PSG, because there is not that extensive tourism actually in Qatar itself.
No, that's a fair point. It's much more of a meaningful sponsorship deal than the Qatar Tourist Authority one back in 2013, which was backdated and that, you know, all sorts of shenanigans, and actually led to PSG getting a sort of fairly hefty, or some may say not hefty enough, financial fair play fine.
They really didn't get much of a fine, did they, when you think of the wealth behind. This is a state-owned club. And got to the point of this, yeah, sure. Okay, Qatar Airways, from a branding point of view, makes a bit of sense, sure. But the thing is, when you have a state-owned enterprise owning a football team, you've got a load of cross-interests. Now, what if Qatar Airways want to sponsor personally some of these players at PSG? It's the same owner. Now, when you're talking about FFP and the amount of money that goes into the pockets of football players that you're trying to sign, what it's the same owner that is basically saying, okay, we're going to pay you your salary at your football club, but we'll also make you a brand ambassador for two or three of our other companies. That is something that a normal football club owner cannot ever dream to do.
And actually, Qatar Airways' reach is far more extensive than some might actually be aware of, because they do own 25% of the International Airlines Group. And in that group, British Airways, Aer Lingus, Iberia, amongst the airlines. So actually, this is the sort of wider reach of Qatar Airways. And Qatar Airways, like Etihad in Abu Dhabi, like the potential new Saudi airline that's talked about, is actually about the sort of diversification of the economy, isn't it, for many years to come. In fact, you know, for these Gulf states to actually have that sort of tangible business that can actually become profitable, as they would hope, over time.
Once more, it's all about the money.
Well, away from the world of football finance, to a recently completed takeover of a club, Chelsea, and new challenges for the ownership led by Todd Boehly, of really distressing news about the culture within the West London club, a toxic culture that, Tarek, you've been reporting on extensively from within the marketing team there, and deeply distressing news about the suicide of a staff member.
Yeah, this was a really tough story to work on. I was working on it for a couple of months, and yeah, the head of Chelsea TV, the former head, Richard Bignall, he passed away in January. Fortunately, it was through after a bout of depression following his losing his job, at Chelsea. Very popular figure. And then looking into that a little bit, talked to several current and former staff, and they talked about, as you say, toxic culture, bullying, all sorts of difficult workplace conditions. Lots of staff had to leave on mental health leave. Many didn't come back. And it is a nasty environment to work in. The story was published this week, and since then, so many more people have come forward. And I just want to say, hope all of those people get the help they need. And the club have finally responded to say they have hired an external group to look into the allegations. And we'll see what comes from that.
Yeah, it's great. Great reporting, Tarek. I mean, I thought it was like particularly sort of pertinent that how you mentioned that initially, that the club commissioned a review of the workplace culture, overseen by the person who was the guy who everybody was complaining about. So it is good news now that it looks like the new owners have commissioned a separate external review of this.
Yeah, and also to the family of Richard Bignall, who passed away, they're talking to the club. Richard left two young daughters behind as well, so it's important that, you know, they have a future and they're looked after. And I think the club has reached out in the last few days to the Bignall family. And you hope all of this is kind of, you can't bring someone who's gone back, but the club do the right thing by the family.
And so much relates to the culture overseen by 12 Tree, the allegation of the tough nature. And how much is this particularly that we see around the world of sports marketing? They've got to produce these deals. They come under pressure to deliver these deals constantly, to deliver the revenue for the clubs. And it's about actually how do you do that in an acceptable manner, and particularly practices that some people might have thought decades ago was sort of the normal rough of the workplace. Actually, at least now, people are seeing that you can't subject people to intolerable pressure and belittling, is the thing you put in your piece, and that sort of culture where you undermine your staff.
The bullying is kind of such an insidious thing, because you kind of, some people can kind of downplay it, but you know, it just in the reporting, it was just having grown adults break down over the circumstances they encounter at work was just really horrible to encounter. And it was not isolated as well. There were so many people who have been kind of broken by this work environment. So then I tried to ask them why they think that happened. And there's other clubs, people at other clubs have come forward since. And there's something about football as well. And maybe even in our business as well, that it seems really exciting and a place that so many people want to work in from the outside. And it meant that there's a churn. As someone said, everyone's so excited to work in sport or football, and they treat you as an expendable tool. That there's going to be another line of people who are willing to do this, and that kind of helps create this environment that let's work these people to the bone. Let's treat them in any way we want, because there's going to be a whole other slew of people willing to replace them, and that really can't carry on. And you hope maybe after something like this, the industry takes a close look at workplace welfare and mental health issues.
This also showed the challenge of how you report concerns internally and whether or not what you're claiming will be acted on, and to what extent as well.
And that's a really good point as well. The thing is, a lot of staff members had approached the human resources department, even up to the outgoing chairman, Bruce Buck. I know people who left wrote to him to say, look, I'm leaving, but you really need to do something about this. People who are following Richard's death, people approached senior officials at the club to say, look, something needs to be done about this. And they were kind of told something would happen, but then it doesn't. And I guess everyone's also, as you said, Rob, there's a sort of fear of reporting in case you then become someone, a persona non grata, and people have mouths to feed at home, rents to pay, etc. And this kind of situation just sort of grows. You're right, reporting needs to be, you know, done, or the ability to report needs to be done without this fear of potential retribution to the people making the report. I'm really interested to see how the next few weeks and months pan out there.
And in terms of the reporting itself, you were working on it for, 2 months? For the wider listener, how did you get this sort of story over the line finally to be published? And obviously, I'm guessing a lot of the sensitivities towards the staff member's family as well who died.
That's exactly the point, especially with this type of thing. It was very complicated. One, also, the reporting, you have to be extremely sensitive, not only to the family members of the people who have passed, but there's people who are deeply troubled as a result of their experiences at work and are still requiring ongoing treatment. This was the other thing. There was a lot of fear. Everyone would only speak on condition of anonymity, either because they're still at work, because they're still in football, or because they're still scared. And that's why it took so long as well. We had to build up a very long dossier of evidence with a lot of witnesses, and then write it in as sensitive way as possible, in order to not upset people who are already have been hurt by what has happened. And it was difficult to get over the line. I'm glad, and they are glad that we managed to do it, because there's always people who ring up saying, when is the story come out, because you've spoken to them about something that really hurts them.
Well, Chelsea said in a statement that the new board believes strongly in a workplace environment and corporate culture that empowers its employees and ensures they feel safe, included, valued and trusted. Initial steps have been taken by the new owners to instill an environment consistent with our values. Our heart goes out to Richard's entire family. His passing has been deeply felt by colleagues at the club and across the football community. And the Chelsea statement went on to talk about the external review team that has been appointed.
Something else around the sort of English football that I've been looking at this week I thought was quite interesting. So Everton is going through a takeover process, and the former Chelsea chief executive, Peter Kenyon, is leading a consortium to try and buy the club. Now, the person who's bankrolling this deal apparently is a guy called M.G. Kaminsky, an American real estate property owner. it's £500 million plus whatever he needs to complete the stadium. And when I looked at the this real estate company, the last available annual report, it sort of, it didn't really add up, because this company has got, I think, something like $73 million in assets. It's defaulted on several loans. It's faced legal action. He's being investigated by the IRS. Yet, you know, his PR representatives insisting that, you know, he's got huge amounts of wealth in other places, and, you know, it won't touch the sides. But I think it's something which shows that people need to look very closely at who they're getting involved with.
Yeah, and we had that Derby incident with Kirchner as well. That kind of almost risked Derby, which is already in administration. People were talking about it disappearing because that deal was the one that was supposed to save it, and then more weeks went by and that thing collapsed. But you're right, in terms of the due diligence and these people, they just appear. And, we keep describing people we don't know as, you know, American billionaire or American millionaire, and we don't know anything about these people. Yet this kind of offhand kind of reporting as well doesn't help the process. The due diligence needs to be there. So you say, Martin, that he's got backing from someone else. Is that the point they're trying to make? That, yeah, he might have this, but he's fronting it on behalf of someone we've not heard about? Is that what they're getting at?
No, they're saying he's providing the money. If he's getting the money from somebody else, then that's a big issue. But they're saying, and an issue also would, you know, for the Premier League owners and directors test. But no, they're saying, no, it's his family's money. It always looks a bit sort of amateurish when you look at this sort of website, which has been, it's like not a website, it's a web page. It's all it is, set up by this CAM Sports Group. In fact, even his real estate companies, it's just a web page. It's not a website.
Well,
it all seems very strange to me.
But if I was a betting man, Martin, and I'm not, I would put my house on the fact this guy will not own Everton based on what you've just described. It's a waste of it, and it's not fair on the fans that these people put their hopes up. The club obviously has lost 350 million plus the last few years. And also, why is Everton up for sale? Isn't Mashiri loaded, or is this because his friend, who doesn't own Everton, Mr. Usmanov, has been sanctioned? Like, if these people were so rich, he's richer than the guy you've just mentioned, why is he selling Everton? Has anyone said that? Has anyone told us that? All we know is his best pal, who, thanks to whom he made all of his money, has been sanctioned by the British government, the European Union, for links to Vladimir Putin, is in trouble. Does anyone know?
Well, they've got the stadium to finance, haven't they?
But he said he could. He said he could do it, didn't he? Until all this business with the Russia's war in Ukraine emerged. Again, it's this thing about the lack of transparency in the process of maybe the Premier League's process about who's fit and proper, or the owners and directors test, whatever you want to call it. We should know a bit more about this stuff.
Yeah, and another interesting aspect of this is I contacted Kaminsky's PR representative and put this all to him, and they said he wanted some time, so I agreed, you know, I'd give him till the next day. And then the next morning, a couple of, I think it's safe to say that they were PR puffs about Kaminsky, appeared in a couple of media, basically saying how this guy was going to ride to the rescue, you know, he was going to been a Premier League fan, although there's nothing to actually suggest he has any sort of prior interest in football, in fact, any sport at all.
Amazing. It's like the handmaidens for this ownership group and anything for a story. I don't know, we all do this job differently, but it isn't our job to you know, raise the profile and likability of name your mystery businessman. I would have thought.
Speaking generally, we've counted it for many years with bidders, potential bidders for clubs, where often there might be scant information about them. Some of it can be provided by their team. Some of it can exist on the internet, but some of it can be self-perpetuating, that one reference is repeated and repeated continuously, whether it's about their wealth, their business successes, or indeed education as well, and where they actually gain qualifications. And it can be hard to trace them back, actually, but perhaps sometimes it can be easy just to repeat it, not correctly, and those checks aren't taking place, which means they just keep on getting reported.
Yeah, but I've got a question for you both, actually. But isn't it also this tension that we all have in doing this job, which is the tension between access and critical reporting? This person is talking to me, so I'm going to say something nice about them. Isn't that part of the issue here? And it's like it's a perpetual one, not just in sports, but if these people, you think, okay, X, Y, and Z is going to be providing you with your back page scoop or some transfer news or whatever piece of information, I'll be nice to them. And you kind of see that across the industry, don't you?
Yeah, it's like, I'm not going to write anything negative about Nadine Dorries getting the Rugby League and Rugby Union mixed up at the launch of the Rugby League World Cup, in case you might give me a story about her transgender policy.
It's a complete tangent to that, but in terms of the Secretary of State for Culture, who has the sports brief in the British government, and her comments this week, it's something that's often tripped up sports ministers over the years when they'd occasionally get the sports quiz on radio in an interview and ask some sort of key questions. That these were prepared remarks, as I understand it, but I suppose it's quite hard as a culture secretary to be across all sports, all culture, all parts of the media.
Wait. For people unfamiliar with what happened, what exactly happened here for people unfamiliar with this?
England is hosting the Men's, Women's and Disability Rugby League World Cups this autumn. And Nadine Dorries was at a Rugby League amateur club in the Northwest as part of a sort of one of the launches to raise the profile of the tournament. And she went off script. She was delivering a speech, and I understand she was ad-libbing, and started to ad-lib the fact. She said, oh, one of my favourite memories is that 2003 drop goal. We were all drinking Bloody Marys at the time at 11 o'clock in the morning. But that, unfortunately, was the Rugby Union World Cup, which Johnny Wilkinson won for England. Now, Rugby Union, Rugby League, there's a very long history of bad blood. That bad blood's not there so much anymore, but it was still seen as being a bit of a howler and actually disrespectful.
How did she explain it away? Just a honest mistake, or what was the? Did she know the difference? Or
she just tweeted that she'd got her codes mixed up and that she's not a sort of doesn't follow it closely. But I mean, this is like somebody who's, you know, born in Liverpool, worked in Warrington, Rugby League heartland. It's a bit strange.
She did actually retweet someone who said, to be fair, Paul Deacon kicking a drop goal in the 2003 Super League Grand Final was a pivotal moment for the Bradford Bulls. Maybe Nadine Dorries is a fan of Bull Mania. So someone did dig out a moment in Rugby League where there was a key drop goal in 2003. Just not the one she was referencing.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't at 11 o'clock in the morning when she was drinking Bloody Marys.
Well, there's a sporting competition starting far sooner in England. It's the Football Women's European Championship, and they begin at Old Trafford next week with England, the host, playing Austria. And it's a really big moment for the women's game, and something we reflected on a few weeks ago when we spoke to the FIFPro head of women's football, Sarah Gregorius. Now, we didn't run all the interview at the time, but now here is the part where we're discussing the European Championship and the challenges for the game in terms of using the moment to highlight what is still needed for women's football in terms of the investment and the conditions for players. So take a listen to Sarah Gregorius. She's the former New Zealand player who now runs the women's game at the Global Footballs Union.
What I'm always wary of is, because I think it's also really important to celebrate the good at the same time, but you don't want to get into this phase of like progress washing, right? Where you just are so hyped about what's happening and you're seeing the great crowds, and but you're not thinking about the broader environment. And like you say, what players may be going back to once the stadium lights are switched off at Wembley, for example. So I think that's always, we have to make sure that, yes, I love the big crowds and I love the fact that it's going to be an exciting tournament. But I don't want there to be progress washing and for that to mean that we don't have the conversation about what still needs to happen. That's certainly what I believe our role at Thief Pro is, to encourage and support like what we do see and all of the progress that is being made, but not forgetting the fact that there is sometimes a very harsh lived reality for some of those players that we're celebrating over the summer. And I think it is important, like you say, to make people, the ones that can make a difference, like commercial sponsors or clubs or, you know, other competition organizers, make them aware of, you know, the role that they can play in a positive way in changing some of those environments for the players. Because if the players are thriving, honestly, just watch, the industry will keep going from strength to strength.
Yeah, I was a member in France at the Women's World Cup in 2019 when, after Italy's run to the quarterfinals ended, the Italy team coach actually used that moment to talk about the issues in Serie A, the need for professionalisation, the end to the amateur status, the players could earn more. Whereas perhaps even some media would have wanted the simple narrative, oh, what a great run it's been to the last eight, you've done it. This is what a moment, where actually that was being used as the moment to spur change, which actually we've now seen in the last few weeks with the change in conditions in Italy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're seeing now with how it's going to go professional for the next season, like maybe that was part of what, you know, created momentum behind that change. So I have so much respect for people that in those moments still can be like, okay, this is great, but there's more work to be done. And here's an issue that needs to be highlighted. I think that you have to have a high level of self-awareness and critical reflective thought to be able to, you know, bring those conversations forwards in those moments. Because like you say, the easiest thing to be, particularly as a coach, would just be to pat yourself on the back and be like, man, I'm doing a great job, and only worry about that.
That's Sarah Gregorius, the Thief Pro head of women's football. A month of football getting underway in England with those big championships.
Yeah, it should be hopefully a good tournament. It's a record number of tickets sold for a women's Euros, and it could be a really positive step.
You know what? It'll be a record number of people, like you say, in the stadiums. Everyone's going to be very excited about it. Now, women's national team football, be it the Olympics, World Cup, Euros, year on year has just been drawing audiences, coverage, and it's been really exciting. The issue that I believe the women's game still faces, and people need to really focus on this, is what happens in between those tournament years or between those tournaments. At the moment, what we're doing is making the women's game ape the men's game, and that feels a bit lazy. Potentially, while everyone's here in Europe for this month, maybe they can start talking about what the future looks like.
A tease of things to discuss as the Euros get underway, but that about brings an end to this week's episode of Sport and Lot from myself, Rob Harris, Tarek Panja and Martin Ziegler. Thank you for listening. As ever, you can message us at Sport and Lot on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. But for now, enjoy the sport, whatever you're watching.